KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
So here's a guy who is involved in everything you know that you like and care about, right? The music you like and politicians you may vote for and athletes you support. But you don't know who he is. Or even if you know who he is, you can't really define what he does other than he makes things happen.
Director Reginald Hudlin knows this because he got a career boost from Clarence Avant early in his career. You may never have heard of Avant, but this enigmatic manager, producer, and record executive has touched the lives of a wide array of people you have heard of. Bill Withers, Hank Aaron, Barack Obama. In his new Netflix documentary, The Black Godfather, Hudlin lines up all those people and many more to reveal the behind-the-scenes story of Clarence Avant, now 88 years old. Hudlin explains how he got all of them to sit for interviews for a doc that will soon drop on Netflix, possibly because Avant's daughter is married to Ted Sarandos. Hudlin also talks about his own career, which kicked off in 1990 with House Party, a Sundance hit that started as a short film at Harvard. But first on the News Banter, the big studios say they may be catching the midnight train out of Georgia. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So in the past week, you know, it's been kind of gradual. Georgia passed this anti-abortion law. Immediately, a debate started about whether or not Hollywood was going to boycott. This law is seen as a dramatic overreach. There are other even more restrictive laws that are in other states. But Georgia has this big tax credit. There's a ton of production. So at first, we had a few people. David Simon, creator of The Deuce and The Wire, came out early. Nina Jacobson from Color Force, which brought you Crazy Rich Asians and The Hunger Games, many, many very successful projects. Mark Duplass and several others said, well, you know what, we're out. But others held back. And then Netflix kind of said, well, you know, we may have a problem if this law goes into effect. And after another pause, Disney, Warner Media, NBC Universal have all piled in.
Yeah, and the party line in the industry seems to be right now that these companies are saying if this law ultimately is enacted and enforced, then we will likely move to pull productions or reevaluate our investment and things like that. So what they're doing is they're not fully coming out against Georgia and they're not saying we're yanking productions now. They are giving themselves some wiggle room. And many legal analysts believe that this law will not survive an appeal and that the Supreme Court is unlikely to take up the abortion issue in a major way before the 2020 election. So I think it's something that these studios feel that they can do without actually putting themselves at much risk here.
Right. I mean, the message here is clearly if you do this down the road, you know, there will be a line that will be crossed and we will have to leave your state and your beautiful tax incentives. So we'll see. This is not a fight that is going to end like in our lifetimes, man. This is I think it's going to go on and on for the rest of our days. Meanwhile, I'm going to turn to a story that we had this past week in The Hollywood Reporter. Jason Mitchell, he was fired. There was a cascade of firings in May. He was fired from a Netflix movie, Desperados. He was fired by his agents, UTA. He was fired by his managers. Everybody pretty much dropped him, and he was fired from The Chi, which is Lena Waithe's show on Showtime. And the question became, what did he do? And as we reported on Desperados, the actresses complained about him very quickly. He was there for, I think, 4 days and was fired 2 days before shooting started. But that seemed to be the trigger for everybody else to say, we are out of the Jason Mitchell business.
Yeah, and the question is, why didn't that happen sooner? And what your reporting revealed this past week is that there's a lot of finger-pointing, blame game going on right now between people at Showtime and Fox, which produces The Chi, and the showrunner, and Lena Waithe, who created the show. And it's an interesting window into how people are handling these types of alleged harassment situations in the Me Too era. Because it seems like everybody kind of wants to do the right thing, but how that actually manifests itself is very different depending on the situation. And clearly you had someone here whose behavior had raised red flags with several people, yet he continued to kind of be given other chances. And he went to a sensitivity training, and then they were going to bring him back for the third season. And then this shoe dropped with Netflix and he was out. Everybody cut ties immediately.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a question. Does everybody want to do the right thing, honestly? I mean, he's the biggest star in The Chi. Lena Waithe has been very outspoken, including to our publication, about how important Time's Up, the movement, is to her. And she said, I've been very involved in Time's Up and that movement for season two. This was talking about The Chi season two. We're making sure that women feel safe. If you want to play that game and be disrespectful and misbehave on set with an actress or anyone, I'll happily call Showtime and say, this person has to go and you will get shot up and it will be a wonderful finale. Now, this didn't happen with Jason Mitchell. The woman who played his girlfriend left the show and he remained in the planned season three. So the question then became, what did Lena Waithe know and when did she know it and what did she do? Now, a source close to her maintained to us that she didn't really know what was going on and she thought things had been resolved. Lena Waithe has made a big point. I hired a black woman to be the showrunner in season two because it was a white man in season one. This was my attempt to address the Jason Mitchell problem. But the fact is she then blamed the second season showrunner, Ayanna Floyd Davis. Ayanna Floyd Davis then fired back and gave us a statement saying that Lena Waithe absolutely knew what was going on, that she, Ayanna Floyd Davis, had made repeated complaints about this guy, went to HR herself, multiple complaints to human resources. So yes, in fact, that was a very direct answer to Lena Waithe's claims. And she addressed that in an interview on the radio show, The Breakfast Club. Let's listen for a minute. She's basically somewhat taking responsibility, but not quite.
And my biggest regret is that I wish I would have just said, forget that, and not trusted anybody to do my job. And I wish I would have just reached out Tiffany on my own and just be like, yo, what's going on? Like, what can I do? Lena, what can Lena do to fix this? And instead, I trusted someone else to do my job.
So, you know, I just wonder, you know, this is a whole array of questions. Showtime had problems on Smilf, a show that ultimately was canceled because of the conduct of the creator showrunner. Now, Lena Waithe was not the showrunner, but she is the creator. She, as she acknowledges, she is identified with the show. Fox 21 produces a show and got all of these complaints. How did this break down again is my question.
Yeah, and it reminds me of the situation that was on the CBS show Bull, where the star of that show was allegedly harassing an actress who was then written off the show. And the actor not only stayed, but the show was renewed for another season. So, you know, you wonder how these things continue to happen in this Me Too era. But there, as you mentioned, there are a lot of conflicting agendas and the profit motive to keep these shows intact is still there.
Absolutely. And Jason Mitchell, in this case, was a bigger star than his co-star and the show. And he was going to stay until he was gone. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
Clarence was an African-American man in Hollywood, defying what Hollywood was supposed to be.
I would hear about people that were in very serious situations when it came to life. And they will say, the only person that can help you with this is Clarence Avon.
Clarence is the bridge from a time where there was no opportunity to a time where doors began to open.
That's former NFL player and actor Jim Brown, Jamie Foxx, and Barack Obama in the new Netflix documentary, The Black Godfather. In the music industry, Clarence Avant is known simply as The Godfather. Avant worked over six decades as an unseen hand in music, movies, and politics. Avant ran away from his North Carolina home in the 1930s after trying to poison his abusive stepfather. Though he had only made it to the ninth grade, he began managing nightclubs in New Jersey and before long was in business with a growing roster of musicians. He moved to L.A., where he ran record labels and became a power player in political fundraising. The director of The Black Godfather is Reginald Hudlin, himself a multi-hyphenate director, producer, writer, and one-time executive as the first head of BET. When he joined us in the studio to talk about his new film, I had to admit, I'm a little embarrassed that I've never covered music, but I've been around for a few minutes, you know, and I did not know who Clarence Avant was. Why do I not know this guy?
Well, because he didn't want you to know who he was, and he worked very hard to make sure you didn't know that. Well, there's a great line by KRS-One, says, real bad boys move in silence. And I think he learned very early on that there was a huge advantage to not being in front. As much as he appreciated the value of celebrity and how much you could get out of celebrity, he also knew there was a great value to being behind the curtain.
Right. The levers of power were not unknown to him.
Yes.
I mean, he's hard to define, really. I think that's one of the challenges you probably had in the film.
Yes. I mean, whenever you have people who live their life to the fullest, and they're and they're just doing everything. Yeah, you quickly outgrow any box that you can put them in. So here's a guy who is involved in everything you know that you like and care about, right? The music you like and politicians you may vote for and athletes you support, but you don't know who he is. Or even if you know who he is, you can't really define what he does other than he makes things happen.
Right.
You know, we have been trying to get him to, write a book, tell his story for 20 plus years. And finally, his daughter convinced him maybe a documentary may be more to your liking. And he kind of agreed with that. And then she said, well, who do you want to have do the movie? And he said, well, I like Reggie.
How long had you known him?
I'd known him for sort of the beginning of my professional career. When music videos first started kind of emerging as a medium, and there was a gap between the birth of music videos and when black artists started doing music videos. So I did some of the first videos for Uptown Records, like Heavy D and the Boys and those folks. And my music friends were all like Clarence Avant, right? Clearly, at the top of Mount Olympus was Clarence Avant. And I would hear about him like that. And then I was up for a movie. They were going to do a movie with Janet Jackson and The Time. So someone said, well, there's this kid, just graduated, made this little short film that was really cute. So they flew me out.
But the film, a short film, which was House Party, had not become a
Yes, had not become a feature film. Yet. Yeah. It was just a little student, my senior thesis. And they were like,
That worked out well, actually.
It worked out. So I came out, and that's when I met Clarence. And I was like, I've heard about this guy. And he was immediately very charming, very down to earth, very grounded. So I got my first job in the movie business developing this movie. And I wrote the first feature-length script I ever did. And the movie didn't go forward, but I got paid enough to buy a computer.
Ah.
And with that computer, I wrote the feature-length script of House Party.
House Party.
So.
As fate would have it, I was having lunch today with somebody in the who knows a lot more about the music business than I do. And I mentioned this interview, and he said that Clarence Avant was someone who could bring in, you see in the film, political figures, but and also the Nation of Islam.
Yes.
I mean, you do allude in the beginning of the film to mob origins because he started in a club, and it's not like, I'm shocked to discover, right? we're not going to play that.
There was gambling in this establishment.
There was gambling, but I'm meaning to say these diverse constituents of—
Yes.
You've got the mob, the politicians, the money men. I don't know that most people glancing would realize all of these people are in this environment to make a thing happen.
Yes. And yes. And if you are going to make things happen, you have to have a working relationship with all parties.
And that's what he did.
I mean, Clarence is a member of a generation that represented the transition.
And then it started in Prohibition, I think, it was the point made in the film.
Exactly. Yeah. And then there was a handoff. But that someone had to deal with the old regime as it transitioned into something else. And Clarence was one of those guys. And to be able to talk with both in a way that got things done was very important and very effective. You just have to judge people for who they are. And lots of times people are complicated.
Especially in the music world.
Exactly. He had the unique ability to evolve.
I mean, one of the gifts that he had was this ability to make, I think in particular, although he had artists and friends and protégés of all colors, I think, but black artists felt particularly, or black talent generally, not just musicians, protected by him.
The thing about Clarence is that he really was a man of principle. He fought for what was fair. So obviously, if you're a black artist or a black anything, you're going to meet a lot more unfairness. So a person who would say, no, you can't buy me. I'm going to fight for what's fair no matter what. You know, he ultimately was never driven by money. He was driven by fairness.
Although he often talked about everything as a number, number is the thing. You know, I forget the catch.
Right, right, right.
Number, number, number.
Yeah.
And that was part of justice, right? Getting the right number.
Yeah, economic justice, being paid fairly, getting paid what you deserve for your services. It's a huge deal. That continues to be a huge deal, right? So, I mean, he was a guy who was like, no, I'm going to fight for fair. But part of him, part of his fight for fairness was it has to be fair for everyone. You'd think like more Martin Luther King does that, but this guy is sort of on the surface level the opposite, right?
Well, he's got this sort of paradox where he says, well, I'm not marching.
Right.
With
Yeah. Well, like, you know, it's like, look, I couldn't march because if someone hit me, I'd hit back. And the thing is, he did hit back, but he hit back not with a brick. He hit back far more effectively.
So he then becomes friendly, I mean, with Clinton first, I think, Bill Clinton.
Well, first, Andy Young.
Oh, right. Of course.
Right.
I mean, going, I was thinking presidents, but we'll make it politicians and we'll broaden the category.
Well, yeah. And it's tragic. There's so much more that we couldn't put it all in the film. He had such a robust life. But I mean, yeah, he cold called Andrew Young. Said, well, you're running for Congress in Georgia? And yeah, I said, yeah. So, okay, I'm going to back you, which is crazy, right? And he did it. And then he would call Andrew and go, well, who's this guy? Who's this peanut guy? Oh, Jimmy Carter. Is he a good guy? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to back him.
And he just, talent spotter.
Right. And that was the thing. He had a golden eye, a golden ear, and would lay bets very early on to very unlikely candidates, whether it's in music or politics or what have you.
So he becomes, I think, kind of a refuge for Bill Clinton, from what I hear.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, he was a straight dealer. I mean, he really was a friend. I mean, I think one of the things that make the Clintons distinctive in political history is that they actually had, or have, rather, black friends.
Mm.
It wasn't just a political position.
Right.
It was like, no, these are my friends. You know, Vernon Jordan is my friend. Clarence Avon is my friend. And Clarence was a guy who, because he had a deep and sincere relationship, he was able to be that navigator in the middle. And he was like, yes, I will fundraise for you, but we're going to make demands of you in terms of you using your position to help the community that's helping you get there.
And just note as an aside that Kamala Harris is the one candidate for the current cycle who's in this film talking about she's no fool. So, I mean, I did not know, for example, that Clarence Avant had played a role with Barack Obama being recognized as the future leader that he, of course, turned out to be.
Yeah, he's a guy who just wants to get things done. And it's like, oh, this guy should speak in prime time. And by Clarence getting him that spot, he was able to give that speech, which turned America on its ear.
The 2004 speech that electrified, that people just were like, who's this guy?
No red states, no blue states, United States.
Coming up after a short break, Reginald Hudlin tells us black filmmakers have finally broken through to the mainstream. Maybe. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Reginald Hudlin, director of the new Netflix documentary, The Black Godfather, which explores the life and career of music pioneer Clarence Avant. In addition to all of Avant's official titles, manager, producer, record executive, the film also reveals that Avant served as a mentor to many artists, including Ludacris.
He understands the bigger that we are together, the bigger we will be as a culture.
Snoop Dogg.
The message that I received from Clarence was just think about those kids that's looking up to me.
And
P. Diddy. He became that mentor for us all. He became that godfather.
When director Reginald Hudlin asked Avant about that unofficial title in his documentary, he responded in typical cantankerous fashion.
Remember the first time someone ever said, you're the godfather?
Well, people call me that. People can call me anything. People have called me a son of a bitch, so what?
We begged for years.
You
please,
begged for years.
You should write a book about your life. You need to tell your story. I'm not doing that. So he rejected that. And then his daughter talked him into...
Well, and she... happens, his daughter happens to be married to Ted Sarandos at
yes.
Netflix.
Yes.
So I'm guessing you didn't have to pitch the project around town, is what I'm saying.
Well, it was very interesting because Ted was a little self-conscious of like he didn't want to feel like.
Oh, here's something about my father-in-law.
Right, yeah.
Just take a look at it, and if you don't like it, say no.
Right. But, you know, at the same time, Clarence is a more than worthy subject.
Right.
But, you know, he certainly did not want to appear self-dealing. He's not. I mean, look, if I say so myself, it's a really good movie, and I think it's what Netflix is great about because they've really elevated documentaries in the public eye. I mean, more people than I've ever known in my life watch documentaries on a regular basis because of their availability.
Netflix, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So control, was that an issue? Like, we're not going to put in this part. You know, that was something of a criticism with the Quincy Jones movie that it was made by Rashida Jones, so duh.
Right.
But, you know, some people felt like, well, it's going to skim over this and not dwell on that.
We were pretty straightforward in the beginning that this could not be a two-hour puff piece about Clarence. That would just be a bad movie.
Right.
You have to have conflict. You have to have problems. And, you know, he had setbacks like any other person does. And for me, those setbacks are exactly what make the movie exciting.
I mean, it's also the artist. It's not just his drawbacks or flaws. You know, the artist, you know, Michael Jackson pops up on the screen and it's hard to figure out what to do with that right now, I think. I don't know if that was a thing when you were cutting the film.
I mean, we talked about it, but I mean, the reality is, are we just going to like...
We can't pretend he didn't exist.
Yeah, we're going to just say, oh, that never happened in history. I mean, I think that's one of the interesting moments we are right now. It's like we've got these people. And look, there's always been great artists who have conducted themselves with unacceptable behavior. And not just artists, I mean, politicians or anything.
Right.
And
although I will say the music industry seems to... I said to this person who was in the music business, is music worse than film? And he said, absolutely. I don't know if you agree with that. You've been in more than one world.
Yeah, I mean, the question is it worse than Wall Street? Is it worse than the military?
I don't know.
Is it worse?
There's a lot of money.
It's
the
easy.
Difference.
Well, yeah. They're famous, right?
So
if you're going to write a tabloid story, even rich is important, but famous is the most important thing, right? Because here's a famous person that you have an emotional connection to, and they did something bad, right? And that's going to be more attractive a story than that same story in Silicon Valley or Wall Street
True.
Or any other industry, right?
Yeah. You were addressing this question of like, you know, what do you do with the history of someone where it becomes so problematic? I don't know the answer.
I think this is where we put our grown-up pants on and go, you know what? That person's complicated. And, you know, they did this thing, which is amazing. And then they did this behavior, which is terrible. And you have to hold both thoughts in your head at the same time. And if you choose not to, you know, why can't consume their entertainment anymore? Okay, that's your choice. But I don't know. I Want Your Back's kind of a great record. I don't know.
That is a problem, especially now. You know, you hear it and everything comes back together in your mind. And it's a shame, right?
Yeah.
So... you got everybody, I think. Is there anybody you couldn't get?
Well, it was very funny because we said, okay, we're going to make this thing in a disciplined way. You know, we'll get this done in a year. We're going to interview 30 people. These are the 30 people. So cut to 3 years later, 75 interviews. Because at the end of every interview, they would say...
You know who you should talk to?
And they would name three people.
Right.
Three people who had no obvious connection to Clarence.
Right.
All bold-faced names, and they would explain the connection, and then another door would open, which lead to another door, and we just...
It's hard to resist walking through the door.
Yes. So finally, I said, Is this a movie or is it a series? Because I could keep going. I had no problem. I mean, one of the benefits to me was I spent 3 years talking with some of the most amazing people in the world. So they were like, no, it's a movie. I'm like, then we have to stop. We just have to stop.
At a certain point. So, I mean, you know, Barack Obama, you just call up and say, hey. Or does Clarence call up and say, hey?
Well, that's the good fortune of having Nicole Avant, Clarence's daughter, as the producer on the film. Nicole, who is absolutely a chip off the old block. She has her own relationships with all these people. But the nicest thing when people say, oh, we're making a movie about Clarence. Okay.
Right.
Let's figure out the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty wonderful.
Well, so let's talk about you. I want to go back to House Party.
Okay.
It was your student film.
Yes.
And you then expand it. It's a Sundance hit.
Yeah.
Life is good, right?
Life's good.
Big success for New Line at the time.
Yes.
I mean, it was like a really big success.
We made the movie for $2.5 million. We made over 10 times our money. And it was one of the most successful films of that decade.
So that was a big deal. And this is, I'm going to read a quote that you, what you said at the time. This is the best time in history to be a Black filmmaker. Spike has created a whole new recognition of the commercial viability of an audience that wasn't being served before. The studio said, Black filmmakers, that's a good idea. But it feels like,
Well, at the time, yes. I mean, here's the thing.
For a minute.
It's cyclical.
Right.
So the first big boom is in the 70s with the Blaxploitation movement. So you have a bunch of low-budget films that some argue saved Hollywood, right? Because mm-hmm. they were making these big-budget disasters like Dr. Dolittle and stuff. And then Superfly and Shaft and Foxy Brown come in. They don't cost a lot. They make a ton of money. And they create this cultural iconography, which is still relevant. I mean, there's a Shaft movie come out in a couple of weeks, right?
So that's true.
You go, boom, that worked. And it lasted for maybe 5-8 years, right? And unlike other trends, Hollywood did not go, oh, this is working. Let's invest in it.
Right. Every movie is a test case.
Right. Everyone, who knew that was going to happen? Well, yeah, if you actually look at the pattern, yes. Right. You know,
if something didn't work, it's like, oh, look, it doesn't work.
Yeah. You know, we're never going to make another Western. We're never going to make another cop movie. That cop movie failed. So it peters out. And then you've got sort of a lull period where the only Black movie stars, in essence, are sort of Eddie Murphy and Prince. And then in the 90s, boom, and Spike and myself and John Singleton and, you know, that whole era. And again, the movies are more diverse in terms of subject matter. They're more personal. We make even more money than the original Blaxploitation boom. It lasts about another, again, close to 10 years. Then it kind of collapses. And then you've only two folks who can make movies are Screen Gems, that division of Sony, and Tyler Perry. And now we have our current era with, again, films bigger than ever before. You got Black Panther, you've got 12 Years a Slave. So more movies, bigger global box office, making more money than ever before. So basically 20-year cycles. And the question is, is this cycle so successful?
That was my next question.
That it's no longer a trend and becomes a permanent part of the landscape.
And the answer?
Well, if you look at the census, you would say, if you've got a brain in your head, you keep making these movies. They're crossing over because there's now a generation of moviegoers and TV watchers who, they just want the cool thing. They don't have, you know, this some weird racial hangup. I mean, it's kind of like they used to say, well, you can't show Black movies down south because, you know, the Southern audience won't accept it. And now the biggest audience for Black movies is the South. So now the excuse is, well, the international market. But now you've got...
Right, we're seeing that start
to go away.
Which
has always been a lie. And so the excuses are now running thin. But the fact is, Black films, Black television shows are enormously profitable. So if you're looking at an objective business case, you know, the argument is made pretty strongly.
Reginald Hudlin is the director of Black Godfather, available on Netflix on June 7th. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. We'll have more from Reginald Hudlin on an upcoming episode. He tells us about writing Black Panther comics, working with Quentin Tarantino, and more. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.